of modern humans were capable of, and Neanderthals were due for a reappraisal. What Boole had taken for the Neanderthals' natural posture, Strauss and Cave determined, was probably a function of arthritis. Neanderthals did not walk with a slouch or with bent knees. Indeed, given a shave and a new suit, the pair wrote, a Neanderthal probably would attract no more attention on a New York City subway than some of its other denizens. More recent scholarship has tended to support the idea that Neanderthals, if not necessarily up to riding incognito on the IRT, certainly walked upright, with a gait we would recognize more or less as our own. In the 1960s, an American archaeologist named Ralph Solecki uncovered the remains of several Neanderthals in a cave in northern Iraq. One of them, known as Shanidar I, or Nandi for short, had suffered a grievous head injury that had probably left him at least partially blind. His injuries had healed, which suggested that he must have been cared for by other members of his social group. Another, Shanidar IV, had apparently been buried, and the results of a soil analysis from the gravesite convinced Solecki that Shanidar IV had been interred with flowers. This he took as evidence of a deep Neanderthal spirituality. We are brought suddenly to the realization that the universality of mankind and the love of beauty go beyond the boundary of our own species, he wrote in a book about his discovery, Shanidar, the First Flower People. Some of Solecki's conclusions have since been challenged. It seems more likely that the flowers were brought into the cave by burrowing rodents than by grieving relatives. But his ideas had a wide influence, and it is Solecki's soulful near humans who are on display in the Neander Valley. In the museum's dioramas, Neanderthals live in teepees, wear what look like leather yoga pants, and gaze contemplatively over the frozen landscape. Neanderthal man was not some prehistoric Rambo, one of the display tags admonishes. He was an intelligent individual. DNA is often compared to a text, a comparison that's apt, as long as the definition of text encompasses writing that doesn't make sense. DNA consists of molecules known as nucleotides, knit together in the shape of a ladder, the famous double helix. Each nucleotide contains one of four bases: adenine, thymine, guanine, and cytosine, which are designated by the letters A, T, G, and C, so that a stretch of the human genome might be represented as ACCT, CCTC, TAAT, GTCA. This is an actual sequence from chromosome 10. The comparable sequence in an elephant is ACCT, CCCC, TAAT, GTCA. The human genome is 3 billion bases, or really base pairs long. As far as can be determined, most of it codes for nothing. The process that turns an organism's long strands of DNA into fragments, from a text into something more like confetti, starts pretty much as soon as the organism expires. A good deal of the destruction is accomplished in the first few hours after death by enzymes inside the creature's own body. After a while, all that remains are snippets, and after a longer while, how long seems to depend on the conditions of decomposition, these snippets too disintegrate. Once that happens, there's nothing for even the most dogged paleogeneticist to work with. Maybe in the permafrost you could go back 500,000 years, Pabo told me, but it's certainly on this side of a million. 500,000 years ago, the dinosaurs had been dead for about 65 million years, so the whole Jurassic Park fantasy is sadly just that. On the other hand, 500,000 years ago, modern humans did not yet exist. For the Genome Project, Pabo managed to obtain 21 Neanderthal bones that had been found in a cave in Croatia. In order to extract DNA, Pabo, or any other paleogeneticist, has to cut up samples of bone and then dissolve them, a process that, for fairly obvious reasons, museums and fossil collectors are hesitant to sanction. Only three of these bones yielded Neanderthal DNA. To compound the problem, that DNA was swamped by the DNA of microbes that had been feasting on the bones for the last 30,000 years, which meant that most of the sequencing effort was going to waste. There were times when one despaired, Pabo told me. No sooner would one difficulty be solved than another would materialize. It was an emotional roller coaster, recalled Ed Green, a biomolecular engineer from the University of California at Santa Cruz, who worked on the project for several years. The project was finally generating useful results, essentially long lists of A's, T's, G's, and C's, when one of the members of Pabo's team, David Reich, a geneticist at Harvard Medical School, noticed something odd. The Neanderthal sequences were, as expected, very similar to human sequences. But they were more similar to some humans than to others. Specifically, Europeans and Asians shared more DNA with Neanderthals than did Africans. We tried to make this result go away, Reich told me. We thought, this must be wrong. For the past 25 years or so, the study of human evolution has been dominated by the theory known in the popular press as out of Africa, and in academic circles as the recent single origin or replacement hypothesis. This theory holds that all modern humans are descended from a small population that lived in Africa roughly 200,000 years ago. Around 120,000 years ago, a subset of that population migrated into the Middle East, and from there, further subsets eventually pushed northwest in Europe, east into Asia, and all the way east to Australia. As they moved north and east, modern humans encountered Neanderthals and other so-called archaic humans who already inhabited those regions. The modern humans replaced the archaic humans, which is a nice way of saying they drove them to extinction. This model of migration and replacement implies that the relationship between Neanderthals and humans should be the same for all people alive today, regardless of where they come from. Many members of Pabo's team suspected that the Eurasian bias was a sign of contamination. At various points, the samples had been handled by Europeans and Asians. Perhaps these people had got their DNA mixed in with the Neanderthals. Several tests were run to assess this possibility. The results were all negative. We kept seeing this pattern, and the more data we got, the more statistically overwhelming it became, Reich said. Gradually, the other team members started to come around. In a paper published in Science in May 2010, they introduced what Pabo has come to refer to as the leaky replacement hypothesis. The paper was later voted the journal's Outstanding Article of the Year, and the team received a $25,000 prize. Before modern humans replaced the Neanderthals, they had sex with them. The liaisons produced children who helped to populate Europe, Asia, and the New World. The leaky replacement hypothesis, assuming for the moment that it's correct, provides the strongest possible evidence for the closeness of Neanderthals and modern humans. The two may or may not have fallen in love. Still, they made love. Their hybrid children may or may not have been regarded as monsters. Nevertheless, someone, perhaps Neanderthals at first, perhaps humans, cared for them. Some of these hybrids survived to have kids of their own, who in turn had kids and so on up to the present day. Even now, at least 30,000 years after the fact, the signal is discernible. All non-Africans, from the New Guineans to the French to the Han Chinese, carry somewhere between 1 and 4% Neanderthal DNA. One of Pabo's favorite words in English is cool. When he finally came around to the idea that Neanderthals bequeathed some of their genes to modern humans, he told me, "I thought it was very cool. It means that they are not totally extinct, that they live on a little bit in us." The Leipzig Zoo, lies on the opposite side of the city from the Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology, but the Institute has its own lab building on the grounds, as well as specially designed testing rooms inside the ape house, which is known as Pongo Land. Since none of our very closest relatives survive, except as little bits in us, researchers have to rely on our next closest kin, chimpanzees and bonobos, and our somewhat more distant relations, gorillas and orangutans, to perform live experiments. The same or at least analogous experiments are usually also performed on small children to see how they compare. One morning I went to the zoo, hoping to watch an experiment in progress. That day, a BBC crew was also visiting Pongo Land to film a program on animal intelligence, and when I arrived at the ape house, I found it strewn with camera cases marked Animal Einsteins. For the benefit of the cameras, a researcher named Hector Marin Manrique was reenacting a series of experiments he'd performed earlier in a more purely scientific spirit. A female orangutan named Dokana was led into one of the testing rooms. Like most orangutans, she had copper-colored fur and a world-weary expression. In the first experiment, which involved red juice in skinny tubes of plastic, Dokana showed that she could distinguish a functional drinking straw from a non-functional one. In the second, which involved more red juice and more plastic, she showed that she understood the idea of a straw by extracting a solid rod from a length of piping and using the now empty pipe to drink through. Finally, in a Mensa-level display of pongid ingenuity, Dokana managed to get at a peanut that Manrique had placed at the bottom of a long plastic cylinder. The cylinder was fixed to the wall so it couldn't be knocked over. She fist-walked over to her drinking water, took some water in her mouth, fist-walked back, and spat it into the cylinder. She repeated the process until the peanut floated within reach. Later, I watched the BBC crew restage this experiment with some 5-year-old children, using little plastic containers of candy in place of peanuts. Even though a full watering can had been left conspicuously nearby, only one of the kids, a girl, managed to work her way to the floating option, and this was after a great deal of prompting. "How would water help me?" one of the boys asked querulously, just before giving up. One way to try to answer the question, "What makes us human?" is to ask, "What makes us different from great apes?" Or, to be more precise, from non-human apes, since, of course, humans are apes. As just about every human by now knows, and as the experiments with Dokana once again confirm, non-human apes are extremely clever. They're capable of making inferences, of solving complex puzzles, and of understanding what other apes are and are not likely to know. When researchers from Leipzig performed a battery of tests on chimpanzees, orangutans, and 2.5-year-old children, they found that the chimps, the orangutans, and the kids performed comparably on a wide range of tasks that involved understanding of the physical world. For example, if an experimenter placed a reward inside one of 3 cups and then moved the cups around, the apes found the goodie just as often as the kids. Indeed, in the case of chimps, more often. The apes seemed to grasp quantity as well as the kids did. They consistently chose the dish containing more treats, even when the choice involved using what might loosely be called math, and also seemed to have just as good a grasp of causality. The apes, for instance, understood that a cup that rattled when shaken was more likely to contain food than one that did not, and they were equally skillful at manipulating simple tools. Where the kids routinely outscored the apes was in tasks that involved reading social cues. When the children were given a hint about where to find a reward, someone pointing to or looking at the right container, they took it. The apes either didn't understand that they were being offered help or couldn't follow the cue. Similarly, when the children were shown how to obtain a reward by, say, ripping open a box, they had no trouble grasping the point and imitating the behavior. The apes, once again, were flummoxed. Admittedly, the kids had a big advantage in the social realm, since the experimenters belonged to their own species. But in general, apes seem to lack the impulse toward collective problem-solving that's so central to human society. Chimps do a lot of incredibly smart things, Michael Tomasello, who heads the Institute's Department of Developmental and Comparative Psychology, told me. But the main difference we've seen is putting our heads together. If you were at the zoo today, you would never have seen two chimps carry something heavy together. They don't have this kind of collaborative project. Pabo usually works late, and most nights he has dinner at the Institute, where the cafeteria stays open until 7 p.m. One evening, though, he offered to knock off early and show me around downtown Leipzig. We visited the church where Bach is buried, and ended up at Auerbach's Keller, the bar to which Mephistopheles brings Faust, in the fifth scene of Goethe's play. The bar was supposedly Goethe's favorite hangout when he was a university student. I had been to the zoo the day before, and I asked Pabo about a hypothetical experiment. If he had the opportunity to submit Neanderthals to the sort of tests I'd seen in Pongoland, what would he do? What did he think they were like? Did he think they'd be able to talk? He sat back in his chair and folded his arms across his chest. One is so tempted to speculate, he said, so I try to resist it by refusing questions such as, do I think they would have spoken? Because honestly, I don't know. And in some sense, you can speculate with just as much justification as I can. The many sites where their remains have been found give plenty of hints about what Neanderthals were like, at least to those inclined to speculate. Neanderthals were extremely tough. This is attested to by the thickness of their bones, and were probably capable of beating modern humans to a pulp. They were adept at making stone tools, though they seem to have spent tens of thousands of years making the same tools over and over again. At least on some occasions, they buried their dead. Also on some occasions, they appear to have killed and eaten each other. Not just Nandi, but many Neanderthal skeletons show signs of disease or disfigurement. The original Neander Valley Neanderthal seems to have suffered from two serious injuries, one to his head and the other to his left arm. The La Chapelle Neanderthal endured, in addition to arthritis, a broken rib and kneecap. These injuries may reflect the rigors of hunting with the Neanderthals' limited repertoire of weapons. The Neanderthals never seem to have developed projectiles, so they would have to have gotten more or less on top of their prey in order to kill them. Like Nandi, both the original and the La Chapelle Neanderthal recovered from their injuries, which means that Neanderthals must have watched out for one another, which, in turn, implies a capacity for empathy. From the archaeological record, it's inferred that Neanderthals evolved in Europe or in Western Asia and dispersed from there, stopping when they reached water or some other significant obstacle. During the last glaciation, when sea levels were so much lower than they are now, there was no English Channel to contend with. This is one of the most basic ways modern humans differ from Neanderthals, and in Pabo's view, it's also one of the most intriguing. When modern humans journeyed to Australia, even though it was the middle of an ice age, there was no way to make the trip without crossing open water. Archaic humans like Homo erectus spread like many other mammals in the old world, Pabo told me. They never came to Madagascar, never to Australia. Neither did Neanderthals. It's only fully modern humans who start this thing of venturing out on the ocean where you don't see land. Part of that is technology, of course. You have to have ships to do it. But there is also, I like to think or say, some madness there. You know? How many people must have sailed out and vanished on the Pacific before you found Easter Island? I mean, it's ridiculous. And why do you do that? Is it for the glory? For immortality? For curiosity? And now we go to Mars. We never stop. If Faustian restlessness is one of the defining characteristics of modern humans, then by Pabo's account, there must be some sort of Faustian gene. Several times, he told me that he thought it should be possible to identify the basis for our madness by comparing Neanderthal and human DNA. If we one day will know that some freak mutation made the human insanity and exploration thing possible, it will be amazing to think that it was this little inversion on this chromosome that made all this happen and changed the whole ecosystem of the planet and made us dominate everything, he said at one point. At another, he said, we are crazy in some way. What drives it? That I would really like to understand. That would be really, really cool to know. One afternoon, when I wandered into his office, Pabo showed me a photograph of a skull cap that had recently been discovered by an amateur fossil collector about half an hour from Leipzig. From the photograph, which had been emailed to him, Pabo had decided that the skull cap could be quite ancient. He thought it might belong to an early Neanderthal, or even a Homo heidelbergensis, which some believe to be the common ancestor from which both humans and Neanderthals are descended. He'd also decided that he had to have it. The skull cap had been found at a quarry in a pool of water. Perhaps, he theorized, these conditions had preserved it, so that if he got to it soon, he'd be able to extract some DNA. But the skull had already been promised to a professor of anthropology in Mainz. How could he persuade the professor to give him enough bone to test? Pabo called everyone he knew who he thought might know the professor. He had his secretary contact the professor's secretary to get the professor's private cell phone number and joked, or maybe only half-joked, that he'd be willing to sleep with the professor if that would help. The frenzy of phoning back and forth across Germany lasted for more than an hour and a half until Pabo finally talked to one of the researchers in his own lab. The researcher had actually seen the skullcap and had concluded that it wasn't very old at all. Pabo immediately lost interest in it. With old bones, you never really know what you're going to get. A few years ago, Pabo managed to get hold of a bit of tooth from one of the so-called hobbit skeletons found on the island of Flores in Indonesia. The hobbits, who were discovered only in 2004, are generally believed to have been diminutive archaic humans, Homo floresiensis. The tooth was dated to about 17,000 years ago, which meant it was only about half as old as the Croatian Neanderthal bones. But Pabo couldn't extract any DNA from it. Then, a year or so later, he obtained a fragment of finger bone that had been unearthed in a cave in southern Siberia, along with a weird, vaguely human-looking molar. The finger bone, about the size of a pencil eraser, was more than 40,000 years old. Pabo assumed that it came either from a modern human or from a Neanderthal. If it proved to be the latter, the site would be the farthest east that Neanderthal remains had been found. In contrast to the hobbit tooth, the finger fragment yielded astonishingly large amounts of DNA. When the analysis of the first bits was completed, Pabo happened to be in the United States. He called his office, and one of his colleagues said to him, "Are you sitting down?" The DNA showed that the digit did not belong to a modern human or to a Neanderthal. Instead, its owner represented an entirely new and previously unsuspected group of hominid. In a paper published in December 2010 in Nature, Pabo dubbed this new group the Denisovans, after the Denisova cave, where the bone had been found. "Giving accepted prehistoric history the finger," ran one of the newspaper headlines on the discovery. Amazingly, or perhaps by now predictably, modern humans must have interbred with Denisovans too, because contemporary New Guineans carry up to 6% Denisovan DNA. Why this is true of New Guineans but not native Siberians or Asians is unclear, but presumably has to do with patterns of human migration. With the discovery of the hobbits and the Denisovans, modern humans acquired two new siblings. And it seems likely that as DNA from other old bones is analyzed, additional human relatives will be found. As Chris Stringer, a prominent British paleoanthropologist, put it to me, I'm sure we've got more surprises to come. At this point, there's no evidence to indicate what wiped out the Denisovans or the Hobbits. However, the timing of their demise, and the general pattern of late Pleistocene extinctions, means there's one obvious suspect. Presumably, since they were closely related to us, both Denisovans and Hobbits had a long gestation period, and therefore shared the megafauna's key vulnerability, a low reproductive rate. All that would have been required to do them in would have been a sustained downward pressure on the number of breeding adults. And the same holds true for our next closest kin, which is why, with the exception of humans, all the great apes today are facing oblivion. The number of chimpanzees in the wild has dropped to perhaps half of what it was 50 years ago, and the number of mountain gorillas has followed a similar trajectory. Lowland gorillas have declined even faster. It's estimated the population has shrunk by 60% just in the last two decades. Causes of the crash include poaching, disease, and habitat loss. The last of these has been exacerbated by several wars, which have pushed waves of refugees into the gorilla's limited range. Sumatran orangutans are classified as critically endangered, meaning they're at extremely high risk of extinction in the wild. In this case, the threat is more peace than violence. Most of the remaining orangutans live in the province of Aceh, where a recent end to decades of political unrest has led to a surge in logging, both legal and not. One of the many unintended consequences of the Anthropocene has been the pruning of our own family tree. Having cut down our sister species, the Neanderthals and the Denisovans, many generations ago, we're now working on our first and second cousins. By the time we're done, it's quite possible that there will be among the great apes not a single representative left, except, that is, for us. One of the largest assemblages of Neanderthal bones ever found, remains from seven individuals, was discovered about a century ago at a spot known as La Ferrassie in southwestern France. La Ferrassie is in the Dordogne, not far from La Chapelle, and within half an hour's drive of dozens of other important archaeological sites, including the painted caves at Lascaux. For the last several summers, a team that includes one of Pabo's colleagues has been excavating at La Ferrassie, and I decided to go down and have a look. I arrived at the dig's headquarters, a converted tobacco barn, just in time for a dinner of beef bourguignon, which was served on makeshift tables in the backyard. The next day, I drove out to La Ferrassie with some of the team's archaeologists. The site lies in a sleepy rural area, right by the side of the road. Many thousands of years ago, La Ferrassie was a huge limestone cave, but one of the walls has since fallen in, and now it is open on two sides. A massive ledge of rock juts out about 20 feet off the ground, like half of a vaulted ceiling. The site is ringed by wire fence and hung with tarps, which give it the aspect of a crime scene. The day was hot and dusty. Half a dozen students crouched in a long trench, picking at the dirt with trowels. Along the side of the trench, I could see bits of bone sticking out from the reddish soil. The bones toward the bottom, I was told, had been tossed there by Neanderthals. The bones near the top were the leavings of modern humans, who took over the cave once the Neanderthals were gone. The Neanderthal skeletons from the site have long since been removed, but there was still hope that some small bit, like a tooth, might be found. Each bone fragment that was unearthed, along with every flake of flint and anything else that might even remotely be of interest, was set aside to be taken back to the tobacco farm and tagged. After watching the students chip away for a while, I retreated to the shade. I tried to imagine what life had been like for the Neanderthals at La Ferrassie. Though the area is now wooded, then it would have been treeless, There would have been elk roaming the valley, and reindeer and wild cattle and mammoths. Beyond these stray facts, not much came to me. I put the question to the archaeologists I had driven out with. It was cold, Shannon McFerrin of the Max Planck Institute volunteered. And smelly, Dennis Sangaith of Canada's Simon Fraser University said. Probably hungry, Harold Dibble of the University of Pennsylvania added. No one would have been very old, Sangaith said. Later on, back at the barn, I picked through the bits and pieces that had been dug up over the past few days. There were hundreds of fragments of animal bone, each of which had been cleaned and numbered and placed in its own little plastic bag, and hundreds of flakes of flint. Most of the flakes were probably the detritus of tool-making, the Stone Age equivalent of wood shavings, but some, I learned, were the tools themselves. Once I was shown what to look for, I could see the beveled edges that the Neanderthals had crafted. One tool in particular stood out, a palm-sized flint, shaped like a teardrop. In archaeological parlance, it was a hand axe, though it probably was not used as an axe in the contemporary sense of the word. It had been found near the bottom of the trench, so it was estimated to be about 70,000 years old. I took it out of its plastic bag and turned it over. It was almost perfectly symmetrical and, to a human eye at least, quite beautiful. I said that I thought the Neanderthal who had fashioned it must have had a keen sense of design. McFerrin objected. We know the end of the story, he told me. We know what modern culture looks like, and so then what we do is we want to explain how we got here. And there's a tendency to overinterpret the past by projecting the present onto it. So when you see a beautiful hand axe and you say, look at the craftsmanship on this, it's virtually an object of art, that's your perspective today. But you can't assume what you're trying to prove. Among the thousands of Neanderthal artifacts that have been unearthed, almost none represent unambiguous attempts at art or adornment, and those that have been interpreted this way, for instance, ivory pendants discovered in a cave in central France, are the subject of endless, often abstruse disputes. Some archaeologists believe that the pendants were fashioned by Neanderthals, who, after coming into contact with modern humans, tried to imitate them. Others argue that the pendants were fashioned by modern humans who occupied the site after the Neanderthals. This absence has led some to propose that Neanderthals were not capable of art, or, what amounts to much the same thing, not interested in it. We may see the hand axe as beautiful. They saw it as useful. Genomically speaking, they lacked what might be called the aesthetic mutation. On my last day in the Dordogne, I went to visit a nearby archaeological site, a human site, called the Grotte de Combarel. The grotte is a very narrow cave that zigzags for nearly 1,000 feet through a limestone cliff. Since its rediscovery in the late 19th century, the cave has been enlarged and strung with electric lights, which have made it possible to walk through it safely, if not altogether comfortably. When humans first entered the grotte, 12 or 13,000 years ago, it was a different matter. Then the ceiling was so low that the only way to move through the cave would have been to crawl, and the only way to see, in the absolute blackness, would have been to carry fire. Something, perhaps creativity, perhaps spirituality, perhaps madness, drove people along nonetheless. Deep inside the grotte, the walls are covered with hundreds of engravings. All the images are of animals, many of them now extinct. Mammoths, aurochs, woolly rhinos. The most detailed of them possess an uncanny vitality. A wild horse seems to lift its head. A reindeer leans forward, apparently to drink. It is often speculated that the humans who sketched on the walls of the Grotte de Combarel thought their images had magical powers, and in a way they were right. The Neanderthals lived in Europe for more than 100,000 years, and during that period, they had no more impact on their surroundings than any other large vertebrate. There is every reason to believe that if humans had not arrived on the scene, the Neanderthals would be there still, along with the wild horses and the woolly rhinos. With the capacity to represent the world in signs and symbols comes the capacity to change it, which, as it happens, is also the capacity to destroy it. A tiny set of genetic variations divides us from the Neanderthals, but that has made all the difference. Chapter 13. The Thing with Feathers. Homo sapiens. Futurology has never been a very respectable field of inquiry, the author Jonathan Schell has written. With this caveat in mind, I've set out for the Institute for Conservation Research, an outpost of the San Diego Zoo, 30 miles north of the city. The drive to the Institute leads past several golf courses, a winery, and an ostrich farm. When I arrive, the place is hushed, like a hospital. Marlies Houck, a researcher who specializes in tissue culture, leads me down a long corridor into a windowless room. She pulls on a pair of what look like heavy-duty oven mitts and pries the lid off a large metal tank. A ghostly vapor rises from the opening. At the bottom of the tank is a pool of liquid nitrogen, temperature minus 320 degrees. Suspended above the pool are boxes of little plastic vials. The boxes are stacked in towers, and the vials arranged upright, like pegs, each in its own slot. Houck locates the box she is looking for and counts over several rows, then down. She takes out two of the vials and places them before me on a steel table. "There they are," she says. Inside the vials is pretty much all that's left of the pauli, or black-faced honeycreeper, a chunky bird with a sweet face and a cream-colored chest that lived on Maui. The pauli was once described to me as the most beautiful, not particularly beautiful bird in the world, and probably it went extinct a year or two after the San Diego Zoo and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service made a last-ditch effort to save it in the autumn of 2004. At that point, a mere three individuals were known to exist, and the idea was to capture and breed them. But just one bird allowed itself to be netted. It had been thought to be female, but turned out to be male, a development that made Fish and Wildlife Service scientists suspect that only one sex of pauli was left. When the captive bird died, the day after Thanksgiving, his body was immediately sent to the San Diego Zoo. Houck raced to the Institute to deal with it. "This is our last chance," she remembers thinking. "This is the dodo." Houck succeeded in culturing some of the cells from the bird's eye, and the results of that effort now make up the contents of the vials. She doesn't want the cells to get damaged, so after about a minute, she slides the vials back in the box and returns them to the tank. The windowless room where the pauli cells are kept alive, sort of, is called the Frozen Zoo. The name is trademarked, and if other institutions try to use it, they are advised they are breaking the law. The room holds half a dozen tanks, just like the one Houck opened, and stored inside of them, in frigid clouds of nitrogen, are cell lines representing nearly 1,000 species. Really, this is just half the zoo. The other half consists of tanks at a different facility, whose location is pointedly kept secret. Each cell line is split between the two facilities, in case the power goes out at one of them. The Frozen Zoo maintains the world's largest collection of species on ice, but an increasing number of other institutions are also assembling chilled menageries. The Cincinnati Zoo, for example, runs what it calls the Cryobiobank, and England's University of Nottingham operates the Frozen Ark. For now, almost all of the species in deep freeze in San Diego still have flesh and blood members. But as more and more plants and animals go the way of the pauli, this is likely to change. While Hauk is busy resealing the tank, I think of the hundreds of bat corpses collected from the floor of Iola's cave that were shipped to the cryo collection of the American Museum of Natural History. I try to calculate how many little plastic vials and vats of liquid nitrogen would be required to store cultures of all of the frogs threatened by chytrid, and the corals threatened by acidification, and the pachyderms threatened by poaching, and the multitudinous species threatened by warming and invasives and fragmentation, and soon I give up. There are too many numbers to keep in my head. Does it have to end this way? Does the last best hope for the world's most magnificent creatures, or for that matter, its least magnificent ones, really lie in pools of liquid nitrogen? Having been alerted to the ways in which we are imperiling other species, can't we take action to protect them? Isn't the whole point of trying to peer into the future so that, seeing dangers ahead, we can change course to avoid them? Certainly humans can be destructive and short-sighted. They can also be forward-thinking and altruistic. Time and time again, people have demonstrated that they care about what Rachel Carson called the problem of sharing our Earth with other creatures, and that they're willing to make sacrifices on those creatures' behalf. Alfred Newton described the slaughter that was occurring along the British coast. The result was the Act for the Preservation of Seabirds. John Muir wrote about the damage being done in the mountains of California, and this led to the creation of Yosemite National Park. Silent Spring exposed the dangers posed by synthetic pesticides, and within a decade, most uses of DDT had been prohibited. The fact that there are still bald eagles in the United States, indeed the numbers are growing, is one of the many happy consequences of this development. 2 years after the ban on DDT, Congress in 1974 passed the Endangered Species Act. Since then, the length to which people have gone to protect creatures listed under the act is very nearly, in the literal sense of the word, incredible. To cite just one of many possible illustrations, by the mid-1980s, the population of California condors had dwindled to just 22 individuals. To rescue the species, the largest land bird in North America, wildlife biologists raised condor chicks using puppets. They created fake power lines to train the birds not to electrocute themselves. To teach them not to eat trash, they wired garbage to deliver a mild shock. They vaccinated every single condor. Today there are about 400, against West Nile virus, a disease, it's worth noting, for which a human vaccine has yet to be developed. They routinely test the birds for lead poisoning. Condors that scavenge deer carcasses often ingest lead shot, and they have treated many of them with chelation therapy. Several condors have been taken in for chelation more than once. The effort to save the whooping crane has involved even more man-hours, most provided by volunteers. Each year, a team of pilots flying ultralight aircraft teaches a new cohort of captive-raised crane chicks how to migrate south for the winter, from Wisconsin to Florida. The journey of nearly 1,300 miles can take up to 3 months, with dozens of stops on private land that owners give over to the birds. Millions of Americans who don't participate directly in such efforts support them indirectly by joining groups like the World Wildlife Fund, the National Wildlife Federation, Defenders of Wildlife, the Wildlife Conservation Society, the African Wildlife Foundation, the Nature Conservancy, and Conservation International. Wouldn't it be better, practically and ethically, to focus on what can be done and is being done to save species, rather than to speculate gloomily about a future in which the biosphere is reduced to little plastic vials? The director of a conservation group in Alaska once put it to me this way: people have to have hope. I have to have hope. It's what keeps us going. Next door to the Institute for Conservation Research, there's a similar-looking, dun-colored building that serves as a veterinary hospital. Most of the animals in the hospital, which is also run by the San Diego Zoo, are only passing through. But the building has a permanent resident, too. A Hawaiian crow named Kanoe. Kanoe is one of about 100 Hawaiian crows, or alala, that exist today, all of them in captivity. While in San Diego, I paid a visit to Kanoe with the zoo's director of reproductive physiology, Barbara Durant, who, I'd been told, was the only person who really understands him. On our way over to see the bird, Durant stopped off at a commissary of sorts to pick up a selection of his favorite snacks. These included mealworms, a hairless newborn mouse, known as a pinky, and the hindquarters of an adult mouse that had been sliced in half, so that it had a pair of feet on one end and a mess of guts on the other. No one is sure exactly why the alala became extinct in the wild. Probably, as with the pouli, there are multiple reasons, including habitat loss, predation by invasive species like mongoose, and diseases carried by other invasive species, like mosquitoes. In any event, the last forest-dwelling alala is believed to have died in 2002. Kanoe was born at a captive breeding facility on Maui more than 20 years ago. He is, by all accounts, an extremely odd bird. Raised in isolation, he does not identify with the other alala, nor does he seem to think of himself as human. He's in a world all to himself, Durant told me. He once fell in love with a spoonbill. Kanoe was sent to San Diego in 2009 because he refused to mate with any of the other captive crows, and it was decided that something new had to be tried to persuade him to contribute to the species' limited gene pool. It fell to Durant to figure out how to win Kanoe's heart, or more to the point, his gonads. Kanoe came fairly quickly to accept her attentions. Crows do not have phalluses. So Durant stroked the area around his cloaca. But at the time of my visit, he still had failed to deliver what she referred to as high-quality ejaculate. Another breeding season was approaching, so Durant was preparing to try again, 3 times a week, for up to 5 months. If Kanoe ever came through, she was going to rush with his sperm to Maui and try to artificially inseminate one of the females at the breeding facility. We arrived at Kanoe's cage, which turned out to be more like a suite, with an antechamber large enough for several people to stand in, and a back room filled with ropes and other corvid entertainments. Kanoe hopped over to greet us. He was jet black from head to talon. To me, he looked a lot like an average American crow, but Durant pointed out that he had a much thicker beak and also thicker legs. Kanoe kept his head tilted forward, as if trying to avoid eye contact. When he saw Durant, I wondered, did he have the avian equivalent of dirty thoughts? She offered him the snack she'd brought. He gave a raucous caw that sounded eerily familiar. Crows can mimic human speech, and Durant translated the caw as, "I know." "I know," Kanoe repeated. "I know." Kanoe's tragicomic sex life provides more evidence, if any more was needed, of how seriously humans take extinction. Such is the pain the loss of a single species causes that we're willing to perform ultrasounds on rhinos and hand jobs on crows. Certainly the commitment of people like Terry Roth and Barbara Durant and institutions like the Cincinnati and the San Diego Zoos could be invoked as reason for optimism. And if this were a different kind of book, I would. Though many of the preceding chapters have been devoted to the extinction or near extinction of individual organisms, the Panamanian golden frog, the great auk, the Sumatran rhino, my real subject has been the pattern they participate in. What I've been trying to do is to trace an extinction event, call it the Holocene extinction or the Anthropocene extinction, or if you prefer the sound of it, the sixth extinction, and to place this event in the broader context of life's history. That history is neither strictly uniformitarian nor catastrophist. Rather, it is a hybrid of the two. What this history reveals, in its ups and downs, is that life is extremely resilient, but not infinitely so. There have been very long uneventful stretches, and very, very occasionally, revolutions on the surface of the Earth. To the extent that we can identify the causes of these revolutions, they're highly varied. Glaciation in the case of the Ordovician extinction, global warming and changes in ocean chemistry at the end of the Permian, an asteroid impact in the final seconds of the Cretaceous. The current extinction has its own novel cause, not an asteroid or a massive volcanic eruption, but one weedy species. As Walter Alvarez put it to me, we're seeing right now that a mass extinction can be caused by human beings. The one feature these disparate events have in common is change, and to be more specific, rate of change. When the world changes faster than species can adapt, many fall out. This is the case whether the agent drops from the sky in a fiery streak or drives to work in a Honda. To argue that the current extinction event could be averted if people just cared more and were willing to make more sacrifices is not wrong exactly. Still, it misses the point. It doesn't much matter whether people care or don't care. What matters is that people change the world. This capacity predates modernity, though of course modernity is its fullest expression. Indeed, this capacity is probably indistinguishable from the qualities that made us human to begin with. Our restlessness, our creativity, our ability to cooperate to solve problems, and complete complicated tasks. As soon as humans started using signs and symbols to represent the natural world, they pushed beyond the limits of that world. In many ways, human language is like the genetic code, the British paleontologist Michael Benton has written. Information is stored and transmitted with modifications down the generations. Communication holds societies together and allows humans to escape evolution. Were people simply heedless or selfish or violent, there wouldn't be an institution for conservation research, and there wouldn't be a need for one. If you want to think about why humans are so dangerous to other species, you can picture a poacher in Africa carrying an AK-47, or a logger in the Amazon gripping an axe. Or better still, you can picture yourself holding a book on your lap. In the center of the American Museum of Natural History's Hall of Biodiversity, there's an exhibit embedded in the floor. The exhibit is arranged around a central plaque that notes there have been 5 major extinction events since complex animals evolved over 500 million years ago. According to the plaque, global climate change and other causes, probably including collisions between Earth and extraterrestrial objects, were responsible for these events. It goes on to observe, right now, we are in the midst of the 6th extinction. This time caused solely by humanity's transformation of the ecological landscape. Radiating out from the plaque are sheets of heavy-duty plexiglass, and beneath the sheets, the fossilized remains of a handful of exemplary casualties. The plexiglass has been scuffed by the shoes of the tens of thousands of museum visitors who have walked across it, probably for the most part oblivious of what's beneath their feet. But crouch down and look closely, and you can see that each of the fossils is labeled with the name of the species, as well as the extinction event that brought its lineage to an end. The fossils are arranged in chronological order, so that the oldest, graptolites from the Ordovician, are close to the center, while the youngest, Tyrannosaurus rex teeth from the late Cretaceous, are farther away. If you stand at the edge of the exhibit, which is really the only place from which to view it, you are positioned right where the victims of the 6th extinction should go. In an extinction event of our own making, what happens to us? One possibility, the possibility implied by the Hall of Biodiversity, is that we too will eventually be undone by our transformation of the ecological landscape. The logic behind this way of thinking runs as follows. Having freed ourselves from the constraints of evolution, humans nevertheless remain dependent on the Earth's biological and geochemical systems. By disrupting these systems, cutting down tropical rainforests, altering the composition of the atmosphere, acidifying the oceans, we're putting our own survival in danger. Among the many lessons that emerge from the geologic record, perhaps the most sobering, is that in life, as in mutual funds, past performance is no guarantee of future results. When a mass extinction occurs, it takes out the weak and also lays low the strong. V-shaped graptolites were everywhere, and then they were nowhere. Ammonites swam around for hundreds of millions of years, and then they were gone. The anthropologist Richard Leakey has warned that Homo sapiens might not only be the agent of the sixth extinction, but also risks being one of its victims. A sign in the Hall of Biodiversity offers a quote from the Stanford ecologist Paul Ehrlich. In pushing other species to extinction, humanity is busy sawing off the limb on which it perches. Another possibility, considered by some to be more upbeat, is that human ingenuity will outrun any disaster human ingenuity sets in motion. There are serious scientists who argue, for instance, that should global warming become too grave a threat, we can counteract it by re-engineering the atmosphere. Some schemes involve scattering sulfates into the stratosphere to reflect sunlight back out to space. Others involve shooting water droplets over the Pacific to brighten clouds. If none of this works and things really go south, there are those who maintain people will still be okay. We'll simply decamp to other planets. One recent book advises building cities on Mars, Titan, Europa, the Moon, asteroids, and any other uninhabited chunk of matter we can find. Don't worry, its author observes. As long as we keep exploring, humanity is going to survive. Obviously, the fate of our own species concerns us disproportionately. But at the risk of sounding anti-human, some of my best friends are humans. I will say that it is not, in the end, what's most worth attending to. Right now, in the amazing moment that to us counts as the present, we are deciding, without quite meaning to, which evolutionary pathways will remain open and which will forever be closed. No other creature has ever managed this. And it will, unfortunately, be our most enduring legacy. The sixth extinction will continue to determine the course of life, long after everything people have written and painted and built has been ground into dust, and giant rats have, or have not, inherited the earth.
The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, was written by Elizabeth Colbert and read by Anne Toomey, with a prologue by the author. It was recorded at Kessler Media Productions in Katona, New York. The recording and mix engineer was Alex Reisdorf. The associate producer was Joanna Solotaroff. The Sixth Extinction, An Unnatural History, was produced and directed by Robert Kessler. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Also from Simon & Schuster Audio by Elizabeth Colbert, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change, read by Hope Davis, with an introduction by the author.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.